very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Brian Chicatosta.
Yeah, pleased to be here.
Brian, it's a great pleasure to interview you. My recollection as a young bloke listening to someone like George Grigorevic calling the game of football on the ABC on the weekend, it used to get called Sicatosto and not Chicatosto. Was that right?
George was probably incorrect. The correct pronunciation is Chicatosto.
Yes.
But growing up, a lot of the Aussies found a little bit hard. And as kids, we were nicknamed Sicko. And so you got, from that, Sicatosto. And still called today. But some of the true blue Italians still call us Chicatosto.
As they should.
And some of the Italian guys still call me Chico.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Sicko has become very popular.
You'll answer to both.
Yeah.
And the same might be said of Cicerellos, not Cicerellos, I suppose.
Yes, and of course a lot of the names were anglicised because coming into Frio, even though there was a great contingent of Italians, mainly Sicilians, of course, to get into the eyes of the Australian people here, we sort of changed our names a bit. I know Italians that came over here, a prominent Italian from Fremantle, and I won't mention his name, but his nickname, we called him Fred. Though we had a very popular Italian name. And it was Fred for many, many years, but now he's gone back, because it's very popular, his name now, gone back to his normal name. So, the names were something that we cherish, and because when we were kids, it wasn't very popular. Because we moved to Fremantle in 54, and there's still that stigma about the war, and et cetera, and it wasn't always a safe place alone for an Italian in Fremantle. And there were a lot of fights.
That's really interesting. Can I get you just to step back a moment? You were born in Australia, but your parents, I think, each came from Italy.
Yes.
And about when did they arrive here?
Well, Dad arrived prior to the war, so he's actually an Australian citizen. Mum arrived during the war, and she came on a boat, and in fact they had to find haven in Singapore because of the Japanese fleet was around, but she finally made it into Fremantle Harbour. So they both lived in Hamel, just out of Waroona. Dad, the Sicatosto family, was mainly market gardens and a few pigs, etc. And the Orlando family, which Mum's name, poultry farm, fruit, dairy farm, etc. And they got to meet each other during the war because my uncle and my grandfather were interned at Rottnest. And therefore, Mum was about 15 years of age, her mother was ill, and she had to look after a dairy farm, which was virtually impossible for a young girl. And that's where Dad came over from his farm to help out with the work. And
to do the right thing.
Yes. He'd done the right thing, all right, because Mum was pregnant after a while. And the fact is that he was enlisted in the army, but he went absent without leave. So did his brother. They couldn't face the fact that all their relations and friends were being interned and they were scot-free.
They were being asked to go and join the army to fight them, in effect.
Yeah. So anyway, that became a part of the family history. Dad ended up in Fremantle Jail. Mum travelled with her grandmother by train to visit him and said to Peter, my dad, that she was pregnant. And he was given half a day off and they travelled to Subiaco where they were married. And the priest at St. John's Church, I think, in Subi. So they had a witness. I don't think they had a best man or what have you. And then straight after the sermon, they had a cup of tea and he was brought back.
He was taken back.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why when they asked four children, and I had two brothers and a sister, were married, Mum organised all the catering and made it a big wedding.
Now, what was your mum's name?
Mum was Emma.
And I think she's a very well-known person around.
Yes,
around
she was. Yeah. She wrote a book about her life history and became very famous.
Published by the Fremantle Press, I think.
Pardon?
Published by the Fremantle Press.
Yes, it was. Yes. Emma, A Translated Life.
Yes.
And she was a great leader within the Italian group. She spent 32 years working at Mills and Wares. We lived in South Terrace, and she would push a bike to work and back, and to take care of the kids. She'd come back at lunchtime on holidays and make lunch, and then she'd push a bike back to Mills and Wares. So, she had a lot of front. She's only small. She's only 4'11¾", and Dad was a 6-footer. So, but none of his children took after Dad and height-wise. We're all 5½-footers sort of thing.
You came in somewhere in between.
Yeah. We moved to Fremantle in 1954. We left Waroona because of work.
So you were what age at that stage?
Six. So I went to South Terrace Primary School to start off with. I was still grade one.
That school was what, near where or on which land the hospital's now
Yeah, the
built.
Hospital's now built there. Yes. From the corner of Alma and South Terrace.
Yes.
I only spent a year and a bit there and then went to Parry Street at St. Pat's.
Yes.
I did year three there and then finally year four at CBC Fremantle.
Right.
My eldest brother Dominic was already going to CBC when we hit 3A.
Right.
And Ron, my other brother, I think he might have gone straight to the St. Pat's because of the intake used to be at 7 years of age or something.
Yes.
Anyhow, the three boys ended up at CBC Fremantle, and my sister Tina, she finished her schooling at St. Pat's, or they then became De Villiers College or something.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was the introduction to Fremantle as a boy.
As a place. And you mentioned a little earlier, and I wanted to come back to this, that growing up, I take, a little bit older than the six, but perhaps even from that age, the Fremantle could sometimes be a dangerous place.
Mm.
But why was that? It was due to ethnic relations.
There were a lot of ethnic groups in Fremantle. There's the Portuguese, there's the Greeks and the Italians, because they're all in Fremantle, a lot of them working with the crayfishing and fishing industry. But in the 60s, in particular, there were a lot of fights. And I can recall when I was finally given permission to play footy, I used to walk from 190 South Terrace to South Beach, and we used to train at the park there.
Oh.
And it was like going through an obstacle course, because there were groups of kids ready to fight. And so that was going on. It wasn't just the Italians and the Aussies, it was the Italians and the Portuguese. So it was quite, and a lot of fights used to be at the Limelight Cafe, which was in High Street, Fremantle, opposite Hoyt's Theatre. There. My brother then became probably the best street fighter around. My eldest brother.
Your older brother?
Yes.
Did he teach you a few tricks, Brian?
Well, he didn't have to teach me any tricks, but his name became famous. And so when I was walking to footy training from then on, leave him alone, that's Sicko's brother. Yeah, so he, it lasted for quite a while, but I think gradually the as you went to school and as we became proficient at footy and different other sports and become part of the wider community, it was in those days Italians really stuck together. And I used to play with the Pensabini family, the Santa Romita, the Gallianos, Capoludis and all Macari families, etc. We all stuck Fiocco, we all stuck together. And then we sort of spread out, and now we're all part of the community. We never hated the Aussies. We loved them, but very hard for them to accept us.
Just trying to think back to why boys, particularly, I suppose, at the age they were, wanted to fight each other. What was the reason for that? Your suggestion is that sport and general assimilation and going to school broke it down, but what do you think led
Well, I don't know whether it was jealousy over girls or trying to get the same girls. As a young fella, I was attracted to the Aussie girls, of course. I married one. Whether that led to jealousy, etc. Football was a great unifier, you know, because when I played South Fremantle Juniors in 1960, I don't think there was another... I'm trying to think of another Italian playing that I don't think there was.
Probably a few Croatians.
No, there weren't any Croatians.
They were further south.
Oh, well, you know, now there's hundreds of them, and they're very good footballers too. I'm trying to think. I think there was a Legina might have played junior footy with me, but there weren't many. I mean, when you come to South Fremantle Footy Club, I don't want to talk about it straight away, but Charlie Osmini was the only Italian there until I came along. So there's very few. And it took me a while to get introduced to Aussie rules because even as a child, I was forced to play soccer.
Uh-huh.
Yes, and the fact is I was playing with St. Pat's soccer. I was only 8, 9 or 10. By the time I went to CBC Fremantle, there's no soccer. You either played the Aussie rules or you know.
That was all that was played.
You had no choice. But the games of inter-school sport, pardon me, was interesting because I hadn't played footy. So I volunteered as a boundary umpire. And this is my introduction to footy, boundary umpire. And one day, the boys from St. Louis, I think it's called John the 23rd College now, but changed its name, they came with one short. So the Christian brother from CBC Freo said, look, we've got a guy just running the boundary. Do you want him to play for you? And, well, better than nothing, you might as well give him a game. So I had me boots on, so that started it. And the trouble is, it got me in trouble because I didn't know I was that good at footy. That I think I kicked about 5 or 6 goals in a hurry, and all of a sudden they said, oh, what's happening here?
You're doing the wrong thing, bro.
Yeah, I know. I was in trouble with a Christian brother on the Monday morning, I could tell you. But, and my dad, of course, didn't know about it, and we had to keep it secret from him. And it was very hard for me to not want to play football after that. And I asked Mum. She said, well, you better not tell Dad that you're playing footy. But I'll tell him you're going to the Cafe Sport. In those days, in 1958, Fremantle Police Boys was opened up, Police and Citizens.
Yep.
And I loved going there. And so Mum would say, well, Brian's gone to the Police Boys. I was a gymnast, boxing, roller skating, anything you could think of, any sporting activity, I was quite interested in. The mistake I made is that my first year of junior football, without Dad knowing, I won the first and best.
Imagine a few people mentioned what a good footballer you were, Brian.
So I ended up asking Mum. I said, Mum, they got the wind-up down at the South Fremantle Footy Club underneath the old grandstand, Victoria Pavilion. He said, you're not going. Otherwise, Dad will find out. I said, well, I think I have to go because Marty McDonald, the league coach from South Fremantle, is going to award me with the first and best trophy. And she says, oh, well, that's it. I said, well, I better go and see your dad. So she managed to see him. But she took him to the first and best count. He didn't know anything about this. And I was awarded the trophy. And from then on, he says, righto, you're playing footy now. So
there's nothing like success.
Yeah, well, and that started the ball rolling with footy.
So about how old were you at that junior football
start? I was 12.
Yes.
Yeah, so in those days it started at under-12s, under-14s,
yes.
And 16s, 18s.
Yes.
So I went straight into under-14s because it was 12 and 13-year-olds played under-14s. When you're 14, you played under-16s.
Yes.
It's not 14 and under. So, and that was a great start. And
well, you had a great, spectacular, highly successful, decorated, as they say, football career. Did you know when you won that junior award that you really wanted to play Aussie rules footy?
I always wanted to play it after that, but it was something that all the kids played footy.
Yes.
I mean, we used to play down at the fish markets in the park there. We'd play in Suffolk Street, you know, imaginary goals. And before we knew it, all the guys, the Pensabinis, the Sound, all of them ended up playing. And so became a like a religion for the boys, that they really wanted to play footy. How good was I? Well, at the time, you know, I found it easy. I really wanted to perfect the skills of the game. And so my best friend at the time was a guy called Tony McHale, still is. And Tony had a decorated coaching career and football career.
Yes.
And when we were playing under 16s for South Fremantle, we decided to kick left foot rather than our normal right foot. And we did it for a whole year at training to try and perfect the left. Much to the annoyance of the coach, because when we first started, we weren't that proficient. We ended up becoming very, very good, of course. And that was another opportunity for me to advance my skills. So I could go left, I can go right, which was good.
Yes.
And it really amazes me now that so many AFL footballers can't do it.
Well, I know I listen to Gerard Healy commentating, and he gets very annoyed with the lads who can't swing onto a left or a right, depending on what they are. It does surprise me too. So you just persevered.
Yes.
And did you come to prefer the other foot more?
Well, I found out that by the time I graduated up the scale, my left foot stab kick was better than my right. I was a right footer.
Yes.
And the days when I played, the drop kicks and the torpedo kicks were in.
Yes.
Now, the universal kick's the drop punt.
Well, I grew up in an age with grandparents living in Subiaco, right off Rockaby Road, and I'd come down from the country and go with my relatives. And Brian Saar in those days would kick out from full back, a drop kick, and he'd landed in the centre pretty much every time, I reckon. But why did all of those kicks, the stab pass and the drop kick and the torp, people get excited about them when they occasionally see them, but why did they go?
Well, I can understand why the drop kick went, because to do a drop kick, you've got to steady to do the kick, and the game became far quicker. And more pressure. So, and I remember Neil Hawke was one of the very first components of the drop punt. But I don't know why the torpedo ever went out. Because even on Sunday in the preliminary final between South and West Perth, the West Perth player in the last quarter did a spiral punt from about 60 metres out.
I saw that.
Went straight
through
the
goal.
Yeah. And
coach probably told him off.
Yeah. And you'll notice today when the AFL players are kicking for goal, if they're 30 metres out, they want to screw the kick over their shoulder.
That's changed enormously, the way people kick at goal, just in about an 18-month period.
Yeah. Mm. And, of course, that was part of the Gaelic game where, because you've got the round ball, you kick it sideways and it goes fairly straight. But in the grand final of 1970, when it rained all day, I was using torpedoes all the time.
Just got it onto your boot and put it
straight
forward.
As an eye. The flat punt from 30, 40 metres out, straight as anything. Because when you're kicking a flat punt, you've got a greater area of contact with your boot, whereas with the drop punt, you've got just the end of the boot.
Yes.
So there's more chance of hitting it on the side. But with the flat punt, you just place it on your foot. It doesn't have to be a perfect spiral kick, but it'll go straight. It can be a flat, go straight through.
Maybe slightly harder to mark, depending on how it comes to
you. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Well, let's talk about that 1970 grand final. There's a big grand final on at Fremantle Oval this Sunday, the 4th of October, Brian. And more or less 50 years ago, if you can believe it, South won a grand final that you were playing in, and South won.
Mm.
Can you remember much of the day?
Oh, the day, well, actually, there is a video of it, so if I do...
That helps to remind
you. That helps, but we finished last in 69, and we weren't looking too good, but Hassaman had come over from Melbourne. He was a... champion footballer with Melbourne. He'd played in about three or four premierships, all Australian. He's a good player. And he was introducing his style of play. And the first thing that we did at training was we had to mark the ball out in front. He said, I know you can do chest marks, but by marking the ball out in front, you're in a position to kick and hand pass. So it took a while. And we did win about seven games. And then we recruited some good players for the 70 season. Len Clark came from Collingwood. John Riley came back from Footscray. Aldenhoff came from Tassie. And a few others. And with the side that was starting to perform fairly well. So we finished second on the ladder. And the side that finished on top, Perth, had beaten us on every occasion that year. That's three times they played. They beat us quite convincingly. And so the first time we got close to them, we beat them by, I think, 3 points in the second semi. But that was a major achievement for us just to get up there close to them. But it gave us confidence leading up into the grand final. And on grand final day, we took a bus. My wife was pregnant. No, she'd already had the baby. That's right, she had the baby on the Monday before the grand final. In fact, it was my daughter's 50th birthday this last Monday. And so in the second semi-final, we went by bus and we were supposed to get off behind the old grandstand at Subi. And as we were coming along Rockaby Road, I think it was, we had to stop for a vehicle and two of the players, the Riley brothers, got off at the wrong entrance. But anyway, we left them there. In the grand final, we did the same thing. The Riley brothers got off at the wrong entrance and we went around to the right one, so we were very suspicious. But I think we were quite keen and we knew we could beat them, so it was a very wet day. And the first quarter and a half was quite close. But we gradually got on top and we were very fierce and determined to win. And we had the confidence to do it. And we won by 43 points at the end on a wet day, which is quite good.
It's a huge margin on a wet day, and you kicked, what, four goals?
Yes.
You won a Simpson medal for the best player on the ground.
Yeah, that was... didn't come as a surprise, because I had a word with Graham Riley, our full-back, prior to the game. And a good mate of mine, Graham, he said, I want you to come into the back line a bit more and help us out, especially when they're kicking with a breeze. And I think that changed my game completely, because in that second, or could have been the second quarter, I was just on my own. There's no one picking me up, just taking marks.
You became the receiver when the ball came out.
Yeah, and...
which is a very modern game plan, actually, isn't it?
Like a kick behind the player. Yes. And Tom Grilicic, who played centre-back, was tremendous. And Danny Sivic was very, very good. And this is where the ethnic connection comes in. We had... Leginas, Chikatosto, Sivic, you know, Grilicic. There was a lot of them there. And they all played big games for South. And but it was a great day for the club. It's the first grand final victory in 16 years. South Fremantle's always had a big supporter base. And it was great that we won the game, and we had that nucleus of a side which, even though we recruited Riley back from Footscray, he was a Fremantle boy. It was good that a lot of them were homegrown products, and it was good for South Fremantle, and it was good for footy in general. But and though I love playing in the grand final, it's not my greatest thrill. Of all the things that near and dear to me more than anything is the introduction of the Aboriginal players.
Let me ask you about that. Really pleased you raised that question, because Indigenous players in South Fremantle are almost synonymous these days. Mm. Let's just step back a little bit in history. As a 6-year-old, as a 12-year-old winning your first footy medal, were you very aware or at all aware of Australian Aboriginal, Indigenous people in and around Fremantle and playing sport?
No. There weren't many. And I can tell you about our junior club, there wasn't one. A lot of the Aboriginal boys, the Noongar people that I know very, very well, did play a lot of footy in the country. There's no doubt about that. But when you look at the history of the South Fremantle Footy Club, there was Black Paddy. That was his name. Jimmy Melbourne was the very first player to play senior football anywhere in Australia. And he started off with West Perth and came to South and Subi. He was our first. And until the Hayward brothers came in the 30s to play for South Fremantle, that was about it. And there wouldn't have been more than when Jimmy Gidgep came up from Bruce Rock in about 66, 65, 66, he was about number 8 or 9, Lindsay Holland and a few. But the guy that actually opened the floodgates for the introduction of Aboriginal footballers to South Fremantle was Sebastian Rioli. Now, Sibby came down in 1972.
He came from the Tiwi Islands.
Yes. And he's an 18-year-old.
How did that come about, that you'd come from north of Darwin on an island to Fremantle, Western Australia?
Well, that's a good question. What had happened is one of the life members of the South Fremantle Footy Club, Dick Woodgate, he prefers to be called Richard, was stationed in the Auditor General's Department in Darwin. And in that capacity, because he was a football man, he played a couple of league games for South, he became the treasurer of the St. Mary's Footy Club. And St. Mary's was formed in the 50s. And from there, he got to know that St. Mary's allowed a lot of Tiwis to play for him. In fact, they were just about, not quite all Tiwi players, but a lot of them. And there was a young fellow called Sebastian Rioli, as an 18-year-old, had won the medal for the best player. He was then in touch with South Fremantle, being a South Fremantle person, then he brought him down. And he organised me to meet him. Now, the funny part about it is I was completely oblivious to the fact that he was a Tiwi and he was an Aboriginal, because the name didn't lend itself to that.
You thought he was Italian.
Yeah. So I said to a couple of Italian blokes that were playing at the time, Stan Magro and Jeff Paganini, I said, there's going to be another ding coming down here, mate. I'm telling you, there's a bloke called Sebastian Rioli coming down from Darwin. He's got an Italian name, but Sebastian's like a Spanish sort of name, so it could be half Spanish, you never know, half Italian. It's when he walked down, he got the shock of my life. And when he walked out, I said, geez, you're a black fella. And he said to me, and you're a ding. I said, I know. So we embraced. We came very close, very close, very close.
Brothers immediately.
Yeah. And he was terrific.
What was it about his football skills that set him apart from many others?
Well, it's one of the things that you need to understand about these Tiwis in particular. And I went up to Melville Arnold a few times, and I was up there when his son was sitting on his lap. He was 2 years of age, in nappies. And one of those little small footies are only about 5 or 6 inches long, right? I was hand passing it to him. He was catching it, and he was kicking it back to me while sitting on his father's lap.
Did you get him to sign a form four or whatever they were in those days?
Yeah. So he's had, he's left a legacy at South Fremantle that is unbelievable. His son, Benjamin, is playing for South Fremantle on Sunday in the grand final.
How exciting is that?
Yeah, so just one of those things. But
so Seb opens up the floodgates for Indigenous footballers. And when you say that, what was the effect on a club like South Fremantle in a very European working port like Fremantle, which was very European looking, Southern Europeans, Western Europeans, Northern Europeans, suddenly you've got this influx of Indigenous players into the club. How does that work?
Oh, they just embraced the fact that they came down. Sebastian made the state training squad after 4 league games. He was an outstanding player. And then it slowly grew. 3 years later came his brother Morris. With Morris, from Cogin up came Stephen Michael, Basil Campbell. 2 years later, Benny Vigona.
Basil was another Tiwi lad?
Yes, they're related. And then from our country zone, from the Pingley area, etc., we got Nicky Winmar, and then the Collards and all that came up. And South Fremantle became synonymous with Aboriginal footballers. Over the years, I reckon I've had at my place, I've had the Wheatras, the Rioli's come and stay with me over the years when they came down from Darwin, you know, to play football for the Northern Territory in different age competitions. Cyril, that played with Hawthorn, his father stayed at my place when he first came down, and it was there was no reason why that Cyril Rioli Jr. wasn't going to be a very good footballer, because his father married a Long, Kathy Long, Michael Long's sister. So you had Long out of Rioli, and it was always going to be something special, and he was. So anyway, now we've got quite a few of them. I mean, even now in the last 2 years, Tim Kelly and Marlon Pickett have gone over to play significant roles.
Yeah, and South Fremantle has been the nursery ground for all of these great players.
Yeah.
And it has to be said, and I think I take this from what you're saying, Brian, that when it comes to racial tensions in Australia over many years and the sort of Australia we grew up in and you had to deal with as an Italian lad being picked on in Frio and then put yourself in the position of Indigenous people, that football's been a great mechanism for breaking down these barriers, what the WAFL and the AFL does today to highlight the contributions of Indigenous people to Australian culture is enormous.
Yeah, a great equaliser, and sport's one of those defining things which brings all races together. Once you put on that red and white jumper of South Fremantle, it doesn't matter what race, what colour, etc. you are, you're part of the team and you're accepted.
Yes.
And it amazes me how much not only South Fremantle supporters, but supporters from all clubs now admire the Stephen Michaels, the Polly Farmers, you know, and they've got that special gift and they've made a great contribution to the game. And it's allowed them to assimilate a lot easier. I asked Dr. Richard Wallace, a mate of mine, I said, Richard, why didn't you come and play for South Fremantle earlier? You know, you were educated, you were etc. He said, we just couldn't get to go there. And but he did. He ended up playing at South for about 50 or 60 reserves games. He wasn't up to that level. And that's why it's so important that when Sebastian Rioli came down and was accepted and he was so successful, became so popular, it opened the floodgates. They just came in. But South Fremantle did a great job in accommodating them, nurturing them. We set them up in families. Now South Fremantle don't have to do that because second generations of those families are living down here. So when Benjamin Rioli came down from Darwin, he's got cousins living here, you know, with their own families, etc. So it's a lot easier. But those initial years, we needed ladies like Ruby Wilson, who looked after them at her house in Hilton Park. So she'd wash and iron and cook, etc., look after them like they were their own kids. And that was all part of getting down there. And it also left the parents back on the islands in Darwin at Easter, so they're getting well looked after.
Yes.
And there's always been South Fremantle people going up to Darwin.
Yes.
I think every year, Jim Christie and his son Peter, who's the president of South Fremantle now, go up there every year.
Yes.
Just to have a chat, talk, etc. Yeah.
So. Well, the Tui Islanders may be even madder about football than your average South Fremantle fan, I should think. I was on Melville Island on one occasion and I was taken by some of the local people out to the graveyard area where the traditional totems are in place as headstones. But I think just about every one of them had the favourite footy team's colours wrapped to it. A lot of St Kilda colours when I was up there. But without going back to dwell on your stellar career in football, where you went on and you played for the state, you were selected as an All-Australian, and I think right next to the famous Lee Matthews, and then you eventually retire from football after many years, you eventually work for South Fremantle Football Club, don't you?
Yes.
How does that come about?
Well, I was teaching at the time at Spearwood Primary School, and I was having my second stint as a teacher. And once again, Richard Woodgate, who's the guy that was instrumental in getting the Rioli's
down. Who we won't call Dick.
Yeah. Approached me to coach the Colts. And that was 84. And I did, and successfully, we won the premiership. And then because we were so successful, they then offered me a job as the development officer. And after negotiating that and et cetera, and at the same time coached the Colts for a second year and development officer. Yeah, okay, so that's how I started. It was good because I do a lot of trips down the country and I'd bring the boys from the Tiwi with me. I'd bring Cyril and Willie Rioli and these guys and the Wheatras, Hills, and these blokes would come with me. And they were great, great days. But in 85, I was then promoted to footy manager. And the coach at the time, I think it was Don Haddo, did it for a couple of years. Then one of my best mates, Stan Magro, coached. And then the wheels fell off. South Fremantle was broke. To the point of, in 89, it was nearly $700,000 in the red.
And this is at a time when the AFL's landing in Perth.
Yeah. And 89 wasn't a good year financially for anyone, but for South Fremantle, particularly bad. So I was asked to take over as a general manager. And I needed a lot of coaching to do that because Stan Magro and I was a groomsman at his wedding. You know, we're a good combination going. He was the coach, I was the footy manager. I could tell him what to do. He never used to listen.
I was going to say, he didn't have to listen to that.
But, and so we started a campaign to eradicate that club debt. And at the time, I used to go to the gym early in the mornings with a friend of mine, and Bill Hughes was there with the guy that had the winery, Dennis Horgan, was it? Yeah. So I approached Bill and I said, the club's broke and your family's been a great part of the club. I wonder if you can come in and have a look and see what you can do. So he was appointed president after a while, and we started our SOS campaign, Save Our Souths. And we recruited a lot of people in that committee, and I had my mate Joe Rottendeller, he came in, Jewfish, Mel Brown, Ross Kelly, quite a few others, and we set down programs to eliminate the debt. And by the time of the Foundation Day Derby in 1992, we were debt-free.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And you must have been, both proud and very satisfied to have achieved that.
Yeah, it was, we couldn't do it without the help of our members and supporters. Pardon me. We had about three or four areas of debt. We owed the Fremantle Council over $90,000. The overdraft in the bank had been, it was 280 and we had more. And we had companies out there, so it just amounted up. So we decided to attack each one individually, etc. The council was the easiest one because the town clerk at the time was Mario Carosella. Mario said, we don't think you'll ever be able to pay off that debt. However, he gave us an incentive by saying that for every dollar you spend on capital works on the Oval, we'll come off your money you owe us, save us doing it. So I had a few friends in the electrical business, and at the time, Richmond Raceway was closing down. It had all those nice lights, which they use for night trotting. So I said to a mate of mine, Joe DePetra, who was a builder, Joe, what do you reckon? Do you reckon we can put up some towers at Fremantle Oval? He said, yeah, I think we can. I says, I can buy those lights from Richmond Raceway, which I think they had over 100. We only needed 50, but we had to buy the whole lot. And I think it cost us about $10,000. for all of them. They just wanted to get rid of them. And so for the lighting project, we approached the Department of Youth Sport and Rec and a few others. We got quite some substantial grants, and which is good. We're putting lights up and the debt from the council is getting eliminated. We had about, we used 52 lights, we had 48 left, so I advertised them. And the only people that bought them, I think two or three, went to the Spearwood Bowling Club where I was a member. And I was selling them for $250 each. Couldn't sell them. So I shouldn't say this, but then they advertised them for $450 each.
And they were rushed.
Gone.
You could underprice yourself sometimes.
Yeah. They were gone because I said, well, I thought the $250 each, they probably weren't good, but $450 they must be in good. They were good, Nick. And the Shire of Augusta Margaret River bought the whole lot. Yeah. At the end of the day, when we turned the lights on for the first game in 1989, they were barely enough lux levels to play. We played Swan Districts in 1992, that's right. And we had about 12,000 people come to the game, watch one of the very first games under the lights.
Yeah.
And we eliminated the 90,000 debt, which was good.
Well, so long as you just turn the lights off at the end to which Swans were kicking, you'd be fired.
No, they well and truly beat us in 92 in that game, which was the last game of the year. We played them the next week in the final and thrashed them.
It's a funny game, football, isn't it? And anything can happen in a finals, and I'll get your predictions before we finish today. But from the experience you've had, general manager at a waffle club in the AFL period, what's the future of football generally? And I imagine it's a pretty optimistic one. And how does local Western Australian Football League and local clubs like the Bulldogs fit into the future? And into the community of Fremantle in particular, Brian, to which you're totally integrated, wedded, a long time member of.
Yeah, the waffle clubs are struggling. We have West Perth who...
had their own troubles.
Big trouble. We're okay now. East Fremantle are just barely surviving, and there's a few others like that. The West Australian Football Commission, which was formed in my time, initially did a very good job. It held the reins on spending and, you know, clubs were overspending. However, since then, things which affected the league has been the introduction of the AFL. And when the West Coast Eagles came in 87, our average crowds went from 10 down to 3. And when the Dockers came in 94, 95, it went from 3 down to about 15. So there was an income stream which we had, which had disappeared. But in order for the AFL to exist, there had to be a license agreement where so much money was pumped back to the clubs. I mean, prior to Fremantle Footy Club coming in at Fremantle Oval, we were making huge profits. I was holding rock concerts, rodeos, the place was asked to hire out, football competitions and other attractions. So we were averaging $150,000 a year, $200,000 a year in profit. As soon as Fremantle came in and took the head lease, no concerts, crowds dwindled, sponsors went over to an AFL because it was greater exposure. So then we really had to work hard. But people at Fremantle are very loyal, and in the 23 years that I was CEO, general manager, I think 21 years in a row we made a good profit. And then the impact, the real big impact, crowds started to dwindle. The football was still good to watch. We still played an important role in development. but the money wasn't getting down to the grassroots level enough. There's a bit of a problem with it now. There's a parliamentary hearings regarding that. The waffle plays an important role and always will. There's talk about eliminating the seconds so that you have your Colts and league. I don't agree with that, but even on Sunday at the grand final, the reserves are playing first and the Colts are second. So they're sort of putting the Colts in a...
Well, you're likely to see the next set of Nat Fifes in the Colts. I suppose that's the attraction.
But we're still producing excellent footballers throughout the whole system. So there needs to be some sort of a plan again. There needs to be a football forum where all facets of the game, country, amateurs, league, get together and start discussing it properly. Yes, they were overstaffed. When I started in the early 80s, if I needed any answer on amateur football, I'd ring Tom Naylor. If I wanted some answers regarding the waffle, it was Neil Judge. Maybe they may have had two or three other people working there, and it ran beautifully. But the fact is that when you want to promote your club, you have to wear your club colours. If you go down to Pingsley, Narrogin, Katanning, and you've got a red and white jumper on, they know where you're from. And for a while, they were wearing Football Development Trust shirts, etc. It just didn't... no sense whatsoever. So, but anyway, the football is still attractive, still good to watch. And as a matter of fact, in many ways, it's more attractive than the AFL. Because I don't really like the way the AFL is being played at the moment. I don't mind watching a couple of sides play, but this short kick backwards sideways, and I'm sorry. The day when I played, and we played East Fremantle, I'd play on Graham Melrose. When we played Perth, it'd be Barry Cable or Chris Misopoulos or someone like that. Today, it's all in. And when they pick the All-Australian sides now, if you're a midfielder, you'll get a game. Because I put a midfielder on the back line and across the centre, it's just not on.
It's a game for midfielders. Everyone's a midfielder.
Yeah, midfielders, welcome.
What would you be selected as today?
Well, there was a time when they said you wouldn't get a game now, you're too small. And then as the game progressed and it became a speed thing, height really wasn't as important. But I'd still be, I started up at South Fremantle on the wing, 2 years on the wing, and then finished off as a rover. So I'd be part of that 18 midfielders running around.
Look, this is one of those interviews I'd love to go for another hour or two, but we're going to have to draw it to a close shortly. I just want to ask you two questions. One just about Fremantle. As a Fremantle person, what Fremantle means to you? What's the answer to that?
It has changed. Fremantle's part of, it's in my blood. The fact that I've moved here in 1954, which is, 66 years ago. Lived in the heart of 190 South Terrace, went to South Terrace Primary School, CBC, played my football in Fremantle. Mum worked at Mills and Wares. All my mates, even now at the bowling club, are the guys I went to school with, etc. There's no other place I'd rather live. Mum unfortunately sold the house in South Terrace in 1965 and we moved out to Wycombe Valley. But I've never been more than about 5 or 6 kilometres away from Frio. Still coming here every Monday and Friday at Geno's for a coffee. As you know, I play at bowls at Fremantle. I live across the road from the Spearwood Bowling Club. Prefer to play at Fremantle. So I'm part, Fremantle's part of me. And what I noticed coming along South Terrace and Market Street today, a lot of empty shops, which is part of that pandemic, I suppose. But to me, I identify as a Fremantle person. And when I go away, overseas, eastern states, it doesn't matter. They say, where are you from? I say Fremantle. I don't say Perth. I don't say Western Australia. I say Freo. And that's how much, that's what it really means to me, and it's just part of it. Just love the place.
The final question to wrap this up, Brian, we've alluded to it. There's a big football match on Sunday at Fremantle Oval. South Fremantle Bulldogs are playing Claremont. Two proud teams. Who and by how much?
Wow. That is a big question. If you have a look at the history, South have won 5 out of the last 6 games. But the one that counted, we got thrashed. But had Jake Ferranca been playing, I'd give us better than even money chance. However, it'd be interesting to see who takes his place. Now, it's all played on the day and its attitude. And Claremont really play a pressure game. If it's a fine day, South Fremantle will win. If it's wet, Claremont. That's how I read it. I see that the forecast is sort of a sunny day, so South by 17 points.
Well, on that very clear and fine note, Brian, thank you for coming and talking to the Shipping News today.
Yeah.
Absolute pleasure.
Good, thanks, Michael.